I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Matt Bracey. He is a partner at Schief and Stone. He is a former litigator and general counsel, and now a business lawyer. He uses his background and perspectives to help both domestic and international businesses. And one of the things I love that Matt said is he believes a lot of business owners are not purchasing legal counsel in the right way, and it's costing them too much money. And as you know, for most people that have a small to medium-sized business, you don't have deep pockets for legal expenses. And so I think this is going to be a really good episode for that. Matt, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we when we first connected, we just started chatting, and I think we went an hour, maybe an hour and a half. I mean, it was just crazy. We probably should have just turned the microphone on at that point and captured it because it was really, really good. But I really appreciate, in my conversations with you, I really appreciate your approach to the law, because I mean, for me, I started, when I moved to Austin, I worked for about 500 person company, but we, our law firm was Fulbright and Jaworski, and they pulled me into some lawsuit they had going on. And it was just stunning the amount of money we spent on that. Yeah. I mean, stunning. And we lost the case, which made it even more painful. Mm-hmm. But it was a stupid case to prosecute. And so I think that's one of the big challenges a lot of, small and mid-sized businesses have. I mean, I know I still deal with this. I shy away of, I probably should pull a lawyer in on this, but do I want to? And so that's something I hope we can cover. But before we go there, I was in the Marine Corps, Department of the Navy. We we hate each other, except we hate the Army and the Air Force more. We agree on that. And but your dad, I think one of the things you told me that surprised me the most, your dad was 50 years old when you were born.
That's right. Yeah, he sure was. Yeah, so I am now 61. I'll let everyone else do the math, but it was when I was born. But yeah, my dad was a career Navy. He was 22 years in the Navy, and he joined the Navy before Pearl Harbor, and he got out after Korea. So you can imagine that wide swath of time in the military. And I mean, he was just a poor kid in the Depression in Michigan. And he and his brother and their dad used to jump rail cars, to take the rail cars into Detroit to look for work every day. Mm. And I think on one of those trips into Detroit, he saw a recruiting office for the Navy and thought, hey, here's a job. And it was really just a job, right? So he was able to join the Navy and do that. And his official MOS was he was a baker. And then, of course, when the war breaks out, you know how it is in the Navy. You always have like your main job, and then sometimes you have your combat position and what you do. And Dad volunteered for the PT boats, which were a new thing at the time, and it was all volunteer because it was very, very dangerous, basically on a plywood speedboat with a aircraft engine on the back, and zipping in and zipping out at night to destroy Japanese ships. And he was involved in the Battle of Guadalcanal and just crazy stuff. But it's typical of my dad and something I admire about him. He passed away when I was six, unfortunately, so a lot of my memories are brief or stories I've inherited from other people around him. Whatever, I'll take it. But one of the things, so there was a, my dad's picture and story is in Life magazine. from the PT boats, and there was a book written about him and his squadron where his name is all over it. In our house, there was never a big display case with the Life magazine article, or never like a place of honor for the book. They were on the top of a shelf, like next to towels and bedding.
Wow.
That's my dad. So just a very humble guy, and so very, very proud to be his son.
Wow. Yeah, I imagine some of that is, I don't know a lot of people that come back from war and really want to talk about it. It's, it's just a horrible thing. Obviously, that was a war that we had run out of choices. We had run out of other choices to avoid that, but oh my goodness. Yeah. And you were also telling me that you were the first, your generation's the first generation in your family to go to college.
So my mom never graduated from high school, and my dad did graduate from high school. But my brother and sister and I all went to college, and so my brother and sister are substantially older than me, so for the most part, I was raised by a single mom, widow, who had never graduated from high school, so it was a little bit of a different perspective, and she did her very best. But one of the things she always encouraged me was to really look ahead to going to college and to trying to better myself, as we say. Of course, college is not the only way to do that, but it was always a matter of her telling me, when you go to college, you can do this, and never if. It was never a question for me that I would go, because just the words she chose and the way she emphasized that, and from a position of not really knowing herself. I mean, there was no example. She couldn't say, when I was in college, I did it up. She didn't. And yet she still kind of encouraged that and encouraged me to be the best I could be. I definitely remember, this is something I remember my father saying, was, it really doesn't matter what you do in life, just be the best you can be at it.
Yeah.
And that sort of blue collar, get it done kind of attitude really pervaded a lot of my early memories.
Well, not only did you go to college, but you went to law degree, law school, and there was I mean, for me, I'm the first in my family to get a graduate degree. I have to admit, part of the reason I went, for the graduate degree was just to be the first. It was kind of that desire, to kind of push the ball forward. But it's wild. It's, I mean, since I went to college, when I went to college, it was a lot more affordable, even inflation adjusted, and it was a lot more useful. I'm not super impressed with what some of the things are thrown in the curriculum these days. It seems like, now I was a bad student in high school and I had to go to community college first to get my, when I was in the Marines to get my grades up. But one of my professors there, I'll never forget this. He said, the purpose of a liberal arts education is not to teach you to do a specific skill. It's to equip you to do anything. And it was really about teaching people how to think. And I feel like, at least my observation is today's graduates have been studying to the test. And if you hit them with something that's unstructured, unexpected, it really throws them off.
Yeah, I see that. And I think it depends on what they're studying too, and it depends on what they're being sort of fed as the purpose of college, like you said. I mean, I've got two kids in college right now myself, right? And so my daughter Catherine is studying acting, and I told her from day one, it's like, don't ever let anyone criticize you for what you're studying. There's always going to be some voice that says, even in a cocktail conversation with me, right? Like, oh, it's going to equip her well to sell, books door to door, or whatever the joke is, today. That was what we used to say about English majors back in the day, right?
Yeah.
But I don't buy that. And I agree with what you said. It's about expanding your mind. It's about learning how to think. It's about all those things that make you a better human being, and leader and business leader and whatever. Now, she does want to be an actress, and so this is a little bit like her trade that she was learning. But
Right.
even if she didn't, I don't care. And so then there's my son who is just finished his first year of college, and he is a business data analytics major. I'm sure that's great. I have zero idea what that is, to be honest. But what does he want to do after college? He wants to be a firefighter.
Oh,
Okay.
wow.
And so the kids have taken my advice to heart, and they're studying what they want to study because they think it's going to make them better, and they don't link that necessarily to what work they do later on, and I love it.
Well, there's a couple observations I've had. One is it seems like one of the fields that, how should I word this? There's more lawyers not practicing law as a percentage than I think almost any other, formal training. And one of the things that strikes me, the other thing that strikes me about law is what I admire is the way that lawyers solve problems, the way they break down problems. And it's like the discipline of studying law, of becoming a lawyer, teaches you a mindset that you see some go into journalism, you see some go into other fields, but it's more what equips them is actually having that discipline that comes through law school of, consuming knowledge, breaking down problems, and figuring out how to approach them.
It's heavy on logic. And that's really how I ended up in law school, to be honest with you, right? So I get through college and because of my circumstances, I had to work while I went to school. It was not necessarily fun. When I got through, I was like, I'll never go to school again. Yay, I'm done, And then I got a job. I was a university administrator at the college where I went to school. They offered me a job, a career level job in the University of California, which was nice. And it paid a decent salary at the time, and the benefits were great. And there's this trajectory you're supposed to be on for your career and whatever. I was so bored. I was bored for a couple of reasons. Number one, because I'd always worked and gone to school, I had no idea what you normal people did in the evening. And so I got off work at 5, and I was like, what on earth are you doing all this time? I have no idea, right? So my girlfriend was like, you should go join a gym and just work out after work. Okay. So that takes an hour. What now? What do you do with all this time? So I was very bored. But in that boredom, what I would do, of course, as any young man would, is I would hang out at her place, and she was studying for the LSAT. She always wanted to be a lawyer. And so what I'm doing is I'm looking over her shoulder at the questions for the practice LSAT. And I'm like, oh, I love this. Oh, I know this. And so it's because it's so logic based. I was like, oh, I could do this, And if the LSAT is a true diagnostic to determine whether or not you fit in that, it was working. And so with her encouragement, I took the LSAT. And I just took it one step at a time. She's like, "Oh, just take the LSAT. You don't have to go to law school." I said, "I can't go to law school. I can't afford it. Whatever. I just take the LSAT." So I did, and I did pretty well. And then she's like, "Well, just apply to some schools, right?" So I did, and applied to some schools, and then I got into a bunch of them. And now it's like, "Oh, now what do you do?" And so I was at the moment where I had to make a decision. But the point of it was, though, the testing and the lead up was all very, very truly diagnostic. So it told me this is something I can do. And boy, that's been true to this day. I feel so lucky to have stumbled into law. I love being a lawyer. I love what I do. I love being a business lawyer. So, right. So I'm a corporate business lawyer. So I do contracts and I do general business advice to companies like General Counsel Service, and I do M&A work. Okay. And I love it. I love the challenge. I love the problems are complex. And I also love the fact, frankly, that I'm not dealing with somebody going to jail or staying out of jail. I'm not dealing with, somebody losing their life or a limb or whatever in a car accident or divorces, God forbid. I don't have any of the emotionally impactful stuff to deal with. I deal with businesses and numbers and stuff like that, which is cool. But I love it. And I feel it's such an honor to be where I am in my career and just happy to do it and happy to help business owners.
Yeah, it's, and when you were talking about that, not having to deal with family law, because there's some horrible things that have that come out there.
Yes.
I remember when I was in the Marines, there was a Marine that worked for me that ended up going to jail, and he was a bad Marine before all that came up, but his he told his lawyer, he listed me as a character reference. And I sat down with his lawyer and I was like, I don't know why he put me as a character reference. I think he's a scumbag. And I was like, if you want to put me on the stand, that's fine, but I'm going to speak the truth. And it was funny. I ran into his lawyer out in town. This was over in Japan. And I ran into his lawyer out in town after the case was over. And I chatted with him a little bit, and he said, yeah, he was a scumbag. He said, but when I'm representing him, I can't let my mind go there. And that's hard. I mean, I have a lot of respect for people who understand they have a duty to represent their clients, even in places where they disagree with them. Now that case involved statutory rape. I would imagine for you run into that as well, but not as severe. You're not in criminal law, but I would imagine you have clients that make a choice and you're sitting there and you probably try to give them options very diplomatically. I always respect the lawyers that I work with have an amazing ability to de-escalate things. But I'm sure inevitably you have clients that are like, no, we're going to go this way, and they're ignoring every bit of your advice, and then you have a choice to make. And how do you process that?
It's a good question, and I speak to a lot of the younger lawyers in the firm about that kind of a thing, and it takes a little discipline to remember what your role is. As a business lawyer, we have a fiduciary duty to our client, right? And so what that means is I am required by law to put my client's interest above my own. So I can never choose something because it's going to benefit me more than the client, right? So I can't say, oh, we should sue this guy because, whatever, because I know it's going to generate a lot of fees, and even though the outcome may not be good. So you have to put that forward in your mind. You have to always remember client, 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 not me. So that's number one. But number two is remembering that you're not the wizard who gets to swoop in and say magic legal words, mostly in Latin, and then everyone says, oh, yes, let's do that, right? You're an advisor. That means that I'm not making the decision. I'm helping the person who's making the decision by equipping them with facts, consequences, law, and then they get to make the decision. And I have to sometimes remind my clients of this because they're like, I don't know, Matt, what do you think? It's like, that's fine to ask me what I think. I said, but don't think that I'm the one who's going to make all the calls. That's your job. I'm there to advise you. And if I advise you, hey, don't do X because it's really risky. And this happens all the time. Like it's happened this week. If today's Wednesday, yeah, it's happened this week. I'll say, hey, look, I don't think you should do this because of these reasons. And they say, okay. And then, well, I think I'm going to do it anyway. That's fine. If you understand what I've told you, you understand the risk. Let's move on. I don't have any ego attached to it. Let's go to the next thing. I'm going to help you down this path the best I can, but it's not my call, and I'm not the wizard who gets to decide how things happen. But that's an important relationship, right? Clients get to make bad decisions all the time, right? Seldom is it ever like something very dramatic, like it's illegal or whatever, right? Which I would have different obligations about. But it's usually like, hey, this is just a bad choice. Okay, I'll give you a really easy example. If I've got a client who comes to me and they're going to set up a new business, and this happens a lot, and they're with their best friend, they've been best friends since they were, five. We're going to start this business together. We're going to be 50-50 owners. Cool. And so I run them through some questions like, okay, well, 50-50 ownership is fine. How are you going to make decisions? 50-50. We're going to make equal decisions on everything. That's a bad idea. Here's why. It can lead to what's called deadlock, which is where no decision can be made because it requires both of you to make it. So let's talk about ways we can get around deadlock. And they listen sometimes. They're like, yeah, I don't really know if I want to go there because we're always going to agree on stuff. Okay. Next step. Let's talk about a way that you can unravel this if you want to, right? So that means one of you wants to get out or one of you wants the other one out. What do we do? Because in the absence of an agreement, there's no easy way to do that. Okay.
Right.
And again, they say, oh, no, we've been best friends since we were five and that's never going to happen or whatever. It's like, okay. You understand that that's a risk. You understand that there's a mechanism put in place to make it easier. And you're telling me you don't want to do it. Oh, yeah, we don't want to do it. Okay. You've understood. You know what's going on, right? And then unfortunately, 6 months later, they come to me. One of them comes to me and says, yeah, it's not working. I need to get rid of this guy. I could be, thankfully, I wake up in the morning being a very optimistic person. I'm a bright side optimistic guy because otherwise it could be very daunting because you see the bad side of all these business decisions too often.
Yeah.
But that's an example, right? My job isn't to demand something or tell you you're crazy if you don't do this or whatever. It's just explain. I explain it. Here's the risk. Here's what's going on. What do you want to do? I want to do this. It's separate from what you said. Okay, cool. Let's go do it. Let's make it the best we can make it. So that's my role. That's my vision of the role of a business lawyer, at least.
And that kind of comes into my world. I talk a lot about autonomy, that if you want people to make decisions they're going to stick to, don't take their autonomy in the process. Set it up so that their decisions are fully autonomous decisions.
Right.
And it's Jerry Springer. You remember him? The
Oh, yeah. Sure.
he talked about the word he used in his book was power. It was all about giving the power. He was able to get what he wanted by giving the jury the power to make the decision. And he, of course, was exceptionally good at that. But that's what I'm hearing you talk about is, at the end of the day, it's the client's decision. And I can imagine that's really hard when you see people making bad decisions and want to help them avoid that future pain. But at the
Yeah,
end of the day, it's still their decision.
that's right. And you have to know your role. I mean, at the top of the discussion today, you mentioned like the right role for a business lawyer. And so I've talked about that a little bit. I want to go into just one more thing about that. And this all kind of feeds into each other, right? So the idea of how you can offer good advice, and sometimes they take it, sometimes they don't, that's fine, but they have to be receptive to it. If they're not receptive to hearing you, if they shut down immediately, that's a break in the good relationship between an attorney and client, because the attorney-client relationship is based on trust, right? So my clients have to trust me because what I'm giving them advice on is the most important thing in their world, often aside from their family. But it is like their family a lot of times. My clients are not publicly traded companies, right? I'm a middle market guy. Okay. That means my clients are founder owners. These are typically not businessmen or women. They are engineers, salespeople who just had a really great idea, or they came into a really great idea, or somehow here they are, and they just keep on working and they're doing really well because it's a great idea. And they wake up one day and they've got 200 or 250 employees and they're just going gangbusters. They don't have a lot of support. And
Right.
that's where I want to come in, right? So I have to have their trust because they have to trust what I'm saying is best for their business and their course they're going on. But and we could talk a lot about the way trust is established and whatever, right? But one thing in particular that I try to counsel people on is like, use your business lawyer correctly. Which means make sure that they are plugged into your thinking, your priorities, whatever, right? So the analogy I tend to use is, don't treat your business lawyer like a vending machine. All right. So if you imagine a vending machine and you walk up to it whenever you want to, and you put a couple bucks in and you press A4 and you get a chocolate bar, okay? You've put the money in, you've gotten the product you want, everything's cool. Some people do try to treat their business lawyer that way. So no communication for a long amount of time, and then an email that says, "Hey, I need a contract that does this. I need it in a week. Produce it for me." Okay, that is the functional equivalent of the vending machine. All right. The problem with, and it's possible to do that, and it happens all the time. Okay. But the product you get is going to be seasoned by what? It'll be my experience and my sensitivities or my guess about yours. Okay. I would prefer it to be yours. So if I'm more in touch with you and I'm aware of what you're doing in the business and where you're trying to go, whatever, I can apply your sensitivities more and try to tailor it better for your circumstance. That's the highest best use. So that requires a lot of touch. And this goes back to something else you mentioned is, of course, everyone's afraid of cost, right? Yes, lawyers are expensive. Lawyers are expensive. Easy for me to say, but business owners probably just need to like figure in it's a cost of doing business. It's like, a business license or whatever else, right? Easy for me to say, and I get that. And I don't, I know it's expensive, but doing it right and having that contact is important. And what I'll do and what a bunch of business lawyers will do is I'll tell my clients, look, if you want to sit around and just chat with me about how your business is going, what's happening, what your plans are for the future, buy me lunch. Buy me a drink. Okay. The clock is not on. I find that horribly offensive when someone charges for a lunch, but the clock is not on and we'll chat and I'll emerge from it knowing more about where you are and where your mindset is and what's important to you. And I can even challenge you sometimes like, oh, you're thinking about expanding here. Well, have you thought about this potential risk? Oh, and we can have a dialogue about it. Very like, and off the clock, which I like. I like the fact that we can do that and just sort of help and advance the ball. So anyway, that's some of my views on how to use your business lawyer better.
I love that. I do the lunch thing when it's a client that I don't want, like an industry I won't work. I did a little bit nonprofit and I realized that's not a happy place. You know, there are people who do marketing for nonprofits and do very well, but it's been a bad experience for me. And so, you know, I run into people that they're like, well, can't you help me out? And my answer is always, well, I tell you what, buy me lunch. And I'll tell you, I'll answer any question you want over the course of lunch. And that's kind of my way of kind of helping them out, because I don't want to leave them helpless, but I also don't want to take them on as clients. And I like what you're doing, how it's, you know, you're not a therapist. You're not sitting there running the clock, listening to somebody just pour out their heart. You're like, hey, let's go to lunch and we'll just talk about it there. I love that.
Yeah, it works pretty well, and I don't know, it's a better way to deepen the relationship also, but like you said though, there's a I take my job very seriously, right? I take the responsibility of my job very seriously, and that extends to anyone who contacts me. So someone calls me out of the blue and they say, oh, I got your name from someone and I've got this problem and it's something I cannot help with, right? Because it's not something we do or something I know about. I'm going to try to put them in the hands of a different lawyer and I'm going to try to see if I can't steer them in the right direction for no reason other than the fact that they reached out to me in trust. And I honor that. And I'm very serious about making sure that someone who reaches out to me in trust is treated with respect and helped in some way if I can.
Let's talk briefly about other ways that people can keep costs down. You know, because if you're dealing with Fulbright Jaworski as I was when I moved to Austin, man, that clock runs fast.
Yeah.
And you know, just fast. And so how can normal businesses, non-public businesses that don't have millions of dollars sitting around just waiting to pay their lawyer,
Yeah.
how do they keep costs down while still getting what
Yeah.
they need?
Sure. The first thing is make sure you've got the right lawyer, right? When I step into representing a business, I will ask like, well, who's representing you now or who has? And because I want to just understand where they're coming from. And if they've had bad experience, I want to know what it is. And so, more often than not, it's either no one or it's my friend Joe from down the street who, he helped me with a DUI one time. And then, I had that car accident. So he helped me with that. And then he said he could help me put together some business contracts. Okay. And I'm sure Joe's a great guy, but he's not a business lawyer. And there's a difference in specializing. And business law itself is a very large umbrella. So there's a lot of categories within business. I'm a corporate guy. I was a litigator before I was a business litigator. So I was trying cases based on contracts. There's real estate and there's intellectual property. All these things are in employment. All these things are subcategories of business law. But finding a business lawyer or firm that can help you is really a key because you're not going to waste time and efforts. And it's almost like so today, right? What happens a lot is clients come to me and they think they're helping me by saying, "Oh, I need a contract to do this thing, and I had AI produce this rough draft for you to look at," right? And I get where they're coming from and I understand the pain. I get it. But more often than not, it's a matter of, I could take what they have and just redline it a lot, so it would look like it was been bled on. Or I could just use my documents that I use that I'm familiar with, and I to try to gently guide it that way in terms of efficiency. But finding the right business lawyer, getting them engaged early sounds counterintuitive, right? So I'm going to save money by spending money early. Okay, what does that mean? Well, hopefully making the right choices in terms of, let's take the easiest example, contracts, right? So in my world, everything is driven by contracts, right? The contract between my client and its vendors, the contracts between my clients and its employees or contractors, my client and its customers, right? All those different facing contracts dictate the way the relationship between those parties is going to go. Having the right language, the right contract in place can save money down the road. There's nothing uglier than trying to litigate a case based on a bad contract, right? And bad can mean it's vague. Okay. In contract world, vague is bad. Okay. And I always tell people when I'm going through a contract, it's like, look, I don't understand what this phrase means. And if I don't understand it, a judge is not going to understand it. Okay. So we have to make sure we put things in words that are clear and concise, not only the choice of words, but the relationship, right? So if you break it down to its basics and you say, you're going to do something, I'm going to do something, and here's the end result, and here's what happens if it goes wrong, and here's the kind of promises we're going to make to each other. That's the contract. Okay. If you keep thinking about it in simple terms, you and I talked about simplifying language earlier. You keep talking about in simplified terms, that's going to zero you in on what you need, right? And emerging from that whole process with a really clear contract will avoid a lot of problems down the road. Now, again, easy for me to say. So what we're talking about is investing money now to save money down the road. Well, a lot of business owners are like, yeah, that's all great, but I don't have very much money right now. So what do I do? And so, you can try to scale it so that it's like not, we don't have to, we don't have to draft the perfect, IBM level contract at first, but let's make sure it's all those things I'm talking about for a pretty efficient amount of money. And that's another thing that can help is with a business law firm like ours, and we're like 65 lawyers in three offices in North Texas. So we have a bench of younger lawyers we can use. And so I can say, well, look, here's the deal. I'm going to use a junior lawyer who's very competent that bills at a lower rate to do the majority of this. And then I'm going to review it. So my time will be limited, their time will be maximized, and that will make a more efficient product for you. And this goes back to, I was general counsel, I was in-house for 13 years. Started out as a litigator, I went in-house. And when you're in-house, I was in three different states, three different companies, in three different roles, kind of. But my final role was I was general counsel for this finance company. And as general counsel, you are the client. So I employed, 75 law firms around the country to handle lawsuits we had going on and other things going on. So I was the consumer of legal services. And so I get the sensitivities. I get like look, I'm sure this was great, but I can't pay for five lawyers I'd ever met to review the same brief. Okay. I mean, I get all that. And I get the fact that in the company that I send my bill to, they got to pass it around, right? So whoever hires me has to pass it to the CFO who's going to look at it and go, what is this? Right. So I understand that sensitivity and can kind of help guide the client to the best, most efficient path, recognizing that we're not going to, create the greatest written document of all time for every single deal. We're going to do the most efficient document we can do.
Yeah, I love that. I love that, Matt. We discovered last time we could just talk for hours. We don't have that much time. This has been so incredible. I just always enjoy my conversations with you.
Thank
How
you.
can folks reach you?
Sure. So my firm is Sheaf and Stone. Our website is not that. Our website is our firm motto, which is Solid Counsel. So it's www.solidcounsel, and that's counsel.com. I'm on there, and LinkedIn and all the other good socials I'm on, and happy to talk to anybody about anything.
And Sheaf is spelled Sheeff. Is that
That's
right?
right. Scheeff. That's right.
All right. Well, Matt, thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Yeah, Craig, thanks so much for having me. I do appreciate our conversations always, and I do feel like we could talk for hours.
Indeed.
Thank you.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.